This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singarian for Jane Lindholm. There's been a lot of talk during this political season about higher education, how to make it free for individuals, how to reduce student debt. But before the government gets around to providing big solutions, how do we help those contemplating college on a micro level? What can be done right now for individuals who struggle to get that post-secondary degree for a variety of reasons, things like tuition costs, lack of guidance or a mentor, no community support? There's a national movement to change the narrative and increase the number of people in the U.S. holding post-secondary degrees to 60% by 2025. In Vermont, organizers want to push that number to 70% of working-age adults. Here to explain why that's important, how it can happen, is Scott Giles. He's CEO of the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation, or VSAC. Scott, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Rick, thank you very much for having me.
All right, this goal is 70% for Vermonters to obtain a high-quality post-secondary degree or credential by 2025. First of all, explain what high-quality degree means.
Certainly. And it's a great question because so often when we hear people talking about this, they think we're talking about just an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree.
Right.
But in many fields, there are credentials that are recognized by employers as having value. So you can imagine folks that have done an apprenticeship in plumbing or electricianship might be able to get a credential from that. In software engineering and software design, oftentimes there are credentials available through Google or Microsoft that employers recognize as being high value, and you get a wage kind of benefit for having received that certificate.
Currently, around 46% of Vermonters hold a post-secondary degree, and you want to get that number to 70%. So how do we get from 46 to 70?
Well, let me talk for a minute about why it is that we got to the place that we are today, and I think that will help answer this question. A group of us who have been kind of working with students of all ages, both adults and traditional age students, started to notice something. And then in our conversations with the Department of Labor, it became clear that coming out of the recession, the workplace had really changed. And 4/5 of the jobs that were generated kind of post-recession required some form of post-secondary education or training. When we talked to the Department of Labor, they were saying that 70% of the high-wage jobs in Vermont that they projected going forward would also require a high-quality credential or a two-year or a four-year degree. And that really provided the foundation for saying, okay, 70% is a target that we should be looking at.
Even though the Lumina Foundation, who's kind of behind the national push, is saying 60%, Vermont's going for 70%.
Well, I have to kind of tell a really compelling moment in a convening that we did. We were looking at that 60% goal, and a member of the state legislature stood up and asked us the question, are we comfortable with the fact that 40% of our adults will not have the degree or credential that we believe that they will need to be able to compete effectively in the workforce and earn a livable wage? I think it was something that stopped the conversation at the time, gave us pause and said, you know what, we need to reach a little bit higher, really as a matter of both social justice and individual equity.
Listeners, 45% of Vermonters currently hold post-secondary degrees. So how do we significantly raise that number? Can we realistically get it to 70% by 2025? Share your thoughts or pose your questions by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Now, Scott Giles, I did ask you, how do we get that number from 46 to 70? You kind of backtracked a little why we want to get there, but now how do we get there?
Sure. So, you know, I think with so many complicated problems, there's not one single solution. But I think that there are some places where we know we can have a real meaningful impact. Let's start with our traditional age, you know, our high school, middle school and high school students. Despite the fact that Vermont has and celebrates rightly one of the highest high school graduation rates, only 60% of our high school seniors who graduate immediately go on to some form of post-secondary education or training. So it's clear that we've got work to be done, particularly when we know that 2/3 of those high-wage jobs will require education or training after high school. So I think we start there. We try and change the conversation so that more of those students understand what jobs are available and the education path that they'll need to follow. Second area that we need to look at is something that we don't talk about much within the public, but not every student that goes on to an education or training program to one of our colleges actually successfully stays and graduates.
As a matter of fact, 14% drop out.
Yeah. In that first year, we'll see 14% of those students drop out. So we have a lot of work to do within the higher education community to make sure that more of those students that successfully arrive on our campuses stay in school and successfully graduate at the end of their four-year or two-year or one-year program. Then the other thing that we need to look at is that group that dropped out. So, you know, sometimes, you know, so often in life we take a look at individuals, we measure success in terms of what's kind of just recently happened to them. There are some 60,000 Vermont adults right now that have some college or training but no degree. Now, some of them really acquired the education or training that they needed to achieve their particular goals. But a substantial portion of them dropped out of school. Life happened to them. There may have been academic or social challenges. They may even have a little bit of student debt as a result of starting school, but they haven't gotten the economic value of that degree. We think that there's a real opportunity to partner with the business and the education community to reach out to that community and help kind of meet their needs.
So there's also this thing, Scott, called the summer melt. This is 16% of Vermonters who intend to sign up for post-secondary programs the fall after high school who don't enroll. Why is that happening and how do we change that?
So much of that is really a kind of a generational issue. The way I when I talk to people about this, I think about my own experience. I was fortunate. I was the second generation in my family to go on to post-secondary education. I had a parent who was the first in our family who kind of knew the ropes, knew how to provide me support, and knew how to keep me on track. For those students that don't have the benefit of a parent or family member or mentor that know those ropes, if you think about it, you graduate from high school, and now your high school doesn't have a role in providing you support.
Right.
You're about to matriculate at a post-secondary education institution, but you're not on that campus and you know, playing the role of a student. So now I have a three-month gap where there's the support structures that I've depended on up till now have gone away. One of the keys to solving summer melt is to really forge closer partnerships between those of us that do the access and aspirational counseling, the higher education, the institutions that are going to be receiving these students, and the school counselors and the schools that are sending them, so that we don't lose students through the cracks during that period when no one owns full responsibility.
Because a lot of doubts start to creep in.
Absolutely.
We got this post from Michael who writes, if the goal will ever be reached, then we need to remove the general education requirements from the degrees. We don't care if our plumber can quote Shakespeare. We want to fix our damn toilet or the electrician or the programmer. When did the skills stop being important and well-rounded liberal arts type degrees take over? Is that a problem where, you know, you have students who really want to focus on something and they have to take, history of England, that they don't see how that applies to, you know, their career down the road?
So one of the wonderful things about that question is that I think it allows us to highlight the diversity of educational programs and opportunities that are available within the state. And it becomes a counseling challenge for students. I think it's really important for us to help students understand what their kind of career and education goals are and then help them find that program that will give them just exactly what they need.
Yeah.
My caution about that, though, is that oftentimes, particularly when we're 17, 18, 19, or 20, we don't know exactly what that is. And I recently had a conversation with some young students graduating from one of our tech centers who will actually be graduating with certificates that will allow them to move directly into the workforce. And I asked him kind of what his educational needs were going to be in the future. And he said, well, I've got my certificate. I'm going to go right into my uncle's kind of plumbing company. And I said, do you always want to work for your uncle or do you think you would like to run that business at some point? So, well, of course I want to run the business. Well, what skills and courses in addition to the outstanding technical skills you've developed do you need to develop in order to successfully do that? So I think we want to be careful not to be so focused that we lose some of the other knowledge and expertise these students will need.
Well, and I'm that kid who had to take History of England, and actually I'm quite glad for it all these years later. Let's go to the phones. We have Jessica calling from Stowe. Jessica, thanks for joining the conversation today on Vermont Edition.
Thank you so much for having me. Yes, I wanted to ask a question to Scott regarding the gap year. You know, I'm a parent, and I've been hearing a lot about how one can use, you know, travel experiences or internships or other types of service learning opportunities to kind of open up their minds to different career pathways, and that, you know, gap year students tend to graduate when they go to college sooner than kind of traditional peers. And I'm just curious what he has to say about gap years and their role in creating more successful college experiences.
Great question, Jessica.
Jessica, thank you so much for that question. You know, one of the challenges, I always start out by saying that you need to take a look at the student that is in front of you and what you know about that particular kind of student. Gap years for the right student can be a real opportunity to kind of broaden their horizons, and for some, a chance to mature and gain a clearer understanding of what's important to them, both in terms of education and potentially career. And that can make their educational experience that much more productive and a smoother transition. The caution that I would offer is the data also suggests, though, that for the wrong student, taking that year off can result in that student not successfully kind of re-enrolling in a post-secondary educational institution or program a year later. Yeah. So it's something that we always counsel parents to really know your student. Be really clear about the goals you have for that gap year program. And if your hope is that they will successfully go on to a 2 or 4 year program, put those plans in place before they go.
All right, Scott, this is from Mark, who writes, I do like that the Agency of Education offers the dual enrollment program for high school students that allows them to obtain several college credits without paying college tuition. For me, this is a great example of how my education tax dollars can actually directly benefit my own kids. I only hope that this program is not discontinued or subject to restricted access before my kids get to that point in school. So dual enrollment, what are you seeing as far as that helping students move on to the college education?
Mark, thank you so much for that question. Vermont now kind of 3 years ago put in place some landmark legislation that did three things. One, required personalized learning plans for every student so that we can begin to provide some really helpful career and education counseling starting in middle school, not in high school when sometimes it can be too late. And then secondarily, it made dual enrollment available to all students and early college as well. So it's also possible for a high school senior to take a full year of college, their senior year, graduate from high school with both a high school diploma and a year of college under their belt. It can be a tremendous tool for reducing the cost of education and giving first-gen and low-income students a taste of what it's like to participate in a college or training program that allows them to have the confidence to successfully go on.
Somehow, a guy in my high school, Joe Mixon, back in the late 70s, figured this out, and he was taking college courses. He'd leave school a little early each day and go over to Moravian College and take college courses, and he was way ahead of us. Now I'm so envious that the rest of us didn't have this opportunity of dual enrollment, which is great. So you said, Scott, that you have spoken to the Department of Labor. I want to know, you know, how do you see this program, this idea of getting 70% of Vermonters with some type of important high-caliber degree, how does it help Vermont's economy?
I think that there are really kind of two ways of answering that question. Let me start by talking about the conversations that we've had with employers as I travel around the state. And I think that Lisa Ventris will be on the show a little bit later.
Coming up next, yes.
She can speak more to this. But many Vermont business owners with kind of small and medium-sized businesses have been telling us now for the last several years that one of the biggest impediments to their growth is their inability to hire workers with the skills that they need. So I think that there's a very real and immediate sense in which our employers are looking for people with skills, and they're not finding them. That poses a threat to our economy as well as an opportunity, because some of them have indicated that they may have to look elsewhere if they can't find or recruit the workforce that they need. Then at the state budget level, there are things that we know about education and its impact on individual lives that have broad macroeconomic impacts. Individuals with post-secondary education and training are dramatically less likely to be incarcerated. They are much healthier. Their health expenses are dramatically lower. They're much less likely to be unemployed. And as I indicated in the beginning, when the recession began to end, while everybody is struggling, 80% of the jobs that came back were those that required education or training. So there's a sense in which the economic engine requires a really highly trained workforce, but there's also a budget implication that's not just more tax dollars collected, but it's all of the budget items that we're struggling with in Vermont could be reduced if we were to achieve this goal.
We're talking about what it will take to get more Vermonters college educated with Scott Giles. He's the CEO of VSAC. You can share your thoughts on the subject by calling 1-800-639-2211. You can also email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. How has a college degree helped your career? Or has the debt you amassed while earning a degree made you question that degree's value? Coming up, we'll hear why the business community thinks a post-secondary degree is important and what it's willing to do to help. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri, and this is Vermont Edition. There's a new push to have 70% of Vermonters to earn a college or post-secondary degree. We're discussing the goal, who's behind it, the challenges involved in getting more Vermonters college educated. I've been speaking with the CEO of the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation, Scott Giles. Now joining us is Lisa Ventris, president of the Vermont Business Roundtable. Lisa, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you very much.
Lisa, we keep hearing that Vermont businesses are having trouble finding people with the requisite skills for the available jobs. How big a deal is that really?
Well, it's a huge deal. A couple observations. When we look at Vermont's long-term unemployment trends and we compare those to what we see against national data, we are very well below what those national averages are. And what it tells us is that employers have been struggling to find adequate numbers of new workers. So we see that sort of in the aggregate macro level, but we also see that reported by our members when we conduct the quarterly business condition survey. And two-thirds of our members regularly comment and have negative outlooks as it pertains to hiring. So this conversation is very timely for the business community.
Does the push for 70% of Vermonters getting degrees come close to providing the business community with what it needs to do business in Vermont?
Well, if we look at from the project that Scott's involved with, their aim is to find 30,000 new Vermonters with degrees that will be help them become eligible for these jobs. That would be a tremendous infusion into the workplace. 70% sounds like a really aggressive goal, but I think that it is worth shooting for and working hard to achieve. Absolutely.
So to get to 70%, there's a lot of elements that need to happen. How do you see businesses partnering with educational organizations to get to that higher rate of educational attainment?
A few things. First of all, I would just point to some of the work that the Roundtable's done. Going back actually to 2006 when we released a report, it was called Having the Courage to Change, and we were stimulating a broader conversation around the need for investing, the business community investing more in the life of our students to at least help them to understand how their education connects them to a successful future. And if a child does not have that vision for themselves, then they're not going to engage in their educational experience or appreciate it, perhaps, in the way that they could and should. Helping, reaching back beyond secondary school and into middle school to help those children develop those aspirations for themselves is a place that is a logical starting point. But what we're seeing across Vermont is that there are the haves and the have-nots when it comes to education. And so if a child doesn't have someone helping them develop those aspirations, whether it is expectations of parents about the fact that they need to go on to post-secondary education, or if they don't have a mentor in their life, those children are disadvantaged in that way. So the business community is interested in having more of connection to classrooms and to educators to help with that visioning.
And Lisa, you speak with these businesses every single day. What are they looking for? What skills, what education are they looking for that is lacking in the state with our workforce right now?
So there are skills gaps, I would say, across a spectrum. Your first questioner questioned the utility of a history class. What I would say is businesses want to hire people who are good communicators, who are problem solvers, who have good soft skills, who are able to read and digest and then apply what they have learned. So having a student graduate from high school with a curriculum that provides exposure to the humanities and sciences is important to employers. We then find that in certain technical industries, they're looking for very specific people. But again, employers are interested in hiring people who can work in teams, who can communicate well, and who can be trained for those specific jobs.
Lisa Ventris is president of the Vermont Business Roundtable. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts today, Lisa.
My pleasure.
So, Scott Giles, you are in charge of VSAC. How do you convince businesses to get involved in programs like Lisa and the Lumina Foundation are espousing to get that number of college graduates in Vermont up to 70%?
Well, let me start out by kind of commending Lisa for the leadership that she has provided both through the roundtable and as an individual in the kind of realm of education. You know, where 4 or 5 years ago, perhaps there was a conversation that needed to take place, but I think that the workforce demands of our employers across the state have become so critical that they're kind of active and willing partners. And Lisa identified one of a couple of ways that I think that they have and can continue to play some real leadership roles. We talked about the importance of kind of shaping kind of attitudes and aspirations in middle school. And in particular, the group that we're concerned about is that 40% that is currently not going on to any post-secondary education, and they tend to be lower income and tend to be first gen. Their world of possibility is defined by the community within which they lived and worked. And businesses have become active in partnering with VSAC and others at coming into the schools simply to talk about you know, the world of their work, you know, local businesses, you know, here's what we do. Here are the skills that you need. And I think they see this as, you know, a long-term investment. Another thing that we have noticed, and it was really interesting through the roundtable's work, was the number of businesses that actually provide education, training, and tuition benefits to their employees. Oftentimes going unused in part because the employees need more guidance regarding what options are available and what directions that they can take. And we see that as a real opportunity where we, VSAC, the higher education community, can partner with the business community to help them make sure that their education and training dollars that they've already set aside are actually being used to achieve both their goals and the state goals.
Got a lot of people waiting to join the conversation. Nicholas is calling from Glover. Nicholas, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Thank you. I have two issues. One is the goal is a laudable one, but I would like to hear more about the equivalency of technical education with this higher education goal. Many Vermonters work with their hands. Their families traditionally have worked in blue-collar occupations. That's where they're headed. And it always sounds as if you were a blue-collar person, that this is something lower. It's a cut down below. And I think that's a disservice to those people. It's all wonderful to have a highly educated workforce, but you also need a lot of people who can run bulldozers, do electrical work. The guys who get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, get in their pickup and drive 2 hours to get to a construction job, they need technical educations, and they'd like to get them. They'd like to be paid as much as somebody who has a graduate degree. And it just doesn't happen under the current system.
Excellent.
The second
point,
thing I'd like to comment on is that briefly mentioned there about the people who are incarcerated. I don't hear anything tying this program into the people who are incarcerated in Vermont. Many of them are fairly well educated or even have college degrees. There's nothing for them in the correctional system. The Department of Education pays no attention to them, and I'd like to hear how you connect this program to give them other opportunities.
Great. Thank you, Nicholas. Scott Giles?
Nicholas, thank you so much for bringing up actually both points.
Yeah.
And I think that the point that you made about technical education is critical and critical to this conversation. So the goal that we've set includes making sure that we have really good, solid pathways, partnering with the tech centers and with those education providers outside of the traditional education system who kind of provide workers with the skills and credentials they need. I was just at the Advanced Welding Institute taking a look at some of their programs kind of a year ago, and that work is incredibly important both to individual Vermonters and to our economy, so I couldn't agree more. Incarceration, you know, this is one that I think there is a role for us kind of broadly as a community to take a look at both how adequately we're educating people before they're incarcerated, but making sure that we provide them with education and training pathways once they have kind of served their time and are reentering the community. I think there's a real opportunity for us to do more to help this group.
So many students coming out with crushing debt out of college. So if I'm on the fence about going to college, hearing those stories about student debt, Scott, what can you say to convince me to go to college?
You know, this is a conversation that is kind of very important, and you hear individual stories, and there are some kind of very, very powerful individual stories, some of which I'm sure that we will hear from some of our callers. The average student debt in Vermont, a report just came out, for a four-year degree is $28,000. Now, that's an average. There are people with more and there are folks with less. In Vermont itself, the wage differential between an individual with a four-year degree and an individual with just a high school diploma is about $11,000 a year. So one way of looking at that question is to say, how long does it take me to pay that, to kind of pay that back? Because education in the end is an investment. The other thing that I think that we need to do is do a better job of making people aware of the flexibility that exists in the repayment of student debt that doesn't exist in any other kind of education debt. Particularly under the federal program where most borrowing takes place, students are eligible for income-based repayment where they pay no more than 10% of their discretionary income, and whatever is left at the end of 20 years, if there is any left, is forgiven. For those that are working in nonprofits or in public service, state government, all of their debt is forgiven at the end of 10 years. So one thing that I think we need to do is a much better job of educating students and their families about the opportunities that will exist for repayment to help them manage that debt.
Scott, if I could make you governor of Vermont right now, which I can do, I have that secret power, what would you push for to get us to that 70% college-educated Vermonters?
You know, I think I would like to put together a kind of a systemic approach that starts with making sure that every middle school and high school student in the state has a personalized learning plan that ties their interests, their aptitudes, and their aspirations to career and to the education training opportunities that are available. Then I would turn to all of those Vermonters that don't have the education or training that they need in order to be able to earn a livable wage. And I would find a way to provide them with that counseling and get them in the training or education program that will allow them to succeed.
The goal is 70% of Vermonters with some type of higher education degree by 2025. How confident are you that we can reach that?
I believe that in a state like Vermont, where we have so many committed partners, we can all come together to achieve this goal.
Scott Giles is CEO of the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation, or VSAC. We've been discussing their push to have 70% of Vermonters earn a post-secondary degree. Scott, thank you so much for joining us today.
Rick, thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, a new book by historian Kenneth Davis looks at slavery from the perspective of five enslaved people. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri. As the United States was fighting furiously to throw off the shackles of British oppression in the late 1700s, nearly a million people were enslaved in American colonies. That number would reach around 4 million by the 1860 census. So how did Washington, Jefferson, and some of the other founding fathers justify the nation's freedom from England while denying it to the enslaved people? Author and historian Kenneth Davis has written a number of Don't Know Much About books, but his latest sheds light on the lives of five people who were enslaved by four U.S. presidents and gives their perspective on the institution and experience of slavery. I asked Davis why he chose this approach and these five people.
For about 25 years, a little more than that, I've been writing about American history, and I was always perplexed, as many people are, by one very basic question. How could these men that we admire, these men who write words like all men are created equal and fight for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and struggle and sacrifice for it, how do these men then go home to plantations utterly dependent upon enslaved labor? It's the great American contradiction. It is the story that a nation conceived in liberty was also born in shackles. And it has always fascinated me and, as I said, perplexed me. For a long time, I wrote about it from the perspective of the men who were doing the enslaving. And I thought I wanted to flip the narrative at this point and try and write and piece together the story of the other side, the people who were legally the property of men like Washington, Madison, Jefferson, and Jackson.
How were you able to find information on their experiences?
What the difference is between these five people and the vast numbers of millions of other enslaved people who are nameless and faceless in history, these people lived in close proximity to some of the most famous men of their day. Their lives were intertwined, and so we have much more documentation, much more record of their daily life, and in some cases, their actual words and experiences as they told them later in their own lives. So there's a rich trove of information, primary source information about these people who were the property of four of the most famous men in our history. What that allows us to do is have an insight into slavery and what it meant as an institution and what it meant in terms of the daily life of these presidents. It was not only the key to their wealth and power, but it provided them the food on their table, the clothes on their back, as well as in other cases, obviously, notorious cases, some other aspects of their life. But this is the human side of the story that often gets left out when we talk about slavery in terms of words like emancipation, abolition, nullification. Those are the political buzzwords and euphemisms. I wanted to put a human face on this story.
Kenneth, Vermont has always applauded itself for being the first state to outlaw slavery, but that doesn't mean it didn't exist here, right?
That's true, and certainly Vermont has a good claim to being the first constitutionally to outlaw or ban slavery. But there are records clearly that there were enslaved people in the state, and there's not even a clear record of how long that was the case. So I think that Vermont certainly gets credit for its idealism in coming into the United States of America and gets some points detracted for the reality. The other thing one must say, though, of course, about Vermont is that its role in the Civil War was extraordinary. And a high number of Vermonters, as a proportion of the population, went off to fight. And also the very, very rich story of the Underground Railroad running through places like Troy into Bennington and further north to Canada. So that's another part of this history a little bit later that Vermont can certainly take pride in.
I've always been under the impression that slavery in colonial America was fairly limited. But how widespread was it, and how large was the African-American population of the time?
Rick, this is one of the most important reasons I think I wrote this book, because we do have so many myths and misconceptions about slavery as an institution, as well as what it was like on an everyday scale. There was no state of the original 13 that did not have slavery. It wasn't something that was limited to a few misguided folks down south. It was the largest business in the country, perhaps in the world, by 1800. So it was the source of enormous wealth. The numbers, if we look at 1790, the census, about 1 million, just slightly under 1 million enslaved African Americans in the 13 colonies, and they were in every one of them. By 1860, of course, that number has grown to 4 million. And this was the great mistake, flaw, failure of men like Washington, Jefferson, Madison. They believed in their hearts that slavery would eventually die. It was foolish optimism, and it was clearly their worst mistake, and I think the thing that we must fault them most for.
Well, how did these American patriots square fighting for independence from England, yet arguing to maintain the system of slavery?
It was a kind of a schizophrenia, I suppose you might call it, a split personality, because you have Washington clearly for most of his life utterly dependent. He was born into a slave plantation life. He inherited his first enslaved people when he was, I believe, 10 years old and his father died. He inherited his first 11 and continued to acquire slaves over the course of his life. When he marries Martha Dandridge Custis, she brings in perhaps another 200 enslaved people because she is the widow of the most wealthy man in Virginia. And she has this large group of what were known as dower slaves, which meant they essentially still belonged to the Custis estate, but the Washingtons now had control over them. So in 1799, Washington has more than 300 people in his control at five different farms in and around the Mount Vernon plantation. But by that time, he had also begun to be uncomfortable with the idea. His views were clearly evolving, and by 1786, he writes, "No one wishes more than I to see a plan for the abolishment of this practice of slavery." But he does so precious little at the peak of his powers and influence and prestige to bring that about. Partly because he's completely wedded to slavery. It is the source of his wealth. It is the source of the food on his table and the clothes on his back, as well as the source of political power. And this is another important fact that we have to go back to our sixth grade civics class. The Constitution, which Washington presided over, established slavery as a fundamental piece of American Republican democracy because it established what we call the three-fifths compromise. Slaves would be counted in the census for the purpose of determining representation in Congress, and that also meant the number of electors each state had. So Virginia, which was the largest slave-holding state at the time, had many more electors and seats in Congress than it would have had if just the white free population was counted. What does that mean in a practical sense? Four of five first presidents are Virginia slaveholders. Five of the first seven presidents are slaveholders. 10 of the first 12. This represented slave power in America in the first half of the 19th century.
What was the long-lasting impact of that three-fifths rule?
Well, the long-lasting impact of it was that the states that had that advantage, that counted those enslaved people, and of course in places like South Carolina and Georgia, as the cotton boom continued and the numbers expanded so dramatically, even after the foreign slave trade was ended, this meant political power. And it meant that their political power was tied to their financial power. Slaves, enslaved people represented wealth. In many cases, it was the only wealth they had. Many slaveholders, like Washington and certainly like Jefferson, were always in debt because they were cash poor. They had this property, but they were often mortgaged up to the teeth.
Are we still seeing the effects of slavery in this country today?
Without a doubt. We see it in the Black Lives Matter movement and the conversations about what's going on, as in the words of one presidential candidate, the inner cities where it's hell. The aftermath of slavery did not end 150 years ago. This is one of the reasons we study history in the first place, to understand what the connections are between past and present. For centuries, not a short amount of time, for centuries, enslaved African Americans were told they were stupid, they were told they were lazy, they were believed to be dishonest, they were believed to be, in the case of young men, uncontrollable, wild, and dangerous. And these perceptions, these stereotypes carried over after centuries of slavery well into the post-Civil War period and up until modern times. So you can't escape that fact. Most pernicious of all, I believe, and many sociologists would probably accept this as a basic truth, is that slavery also destroyed the most fundamental aspect of the society, the family. There was no marriage as we understand it, even though enslaved people might have a husband or a wife. There was no legal standing for that. There was no document. There was no ceremony in a legal sense of a ceremony. There might be a folk ceremony to do this, but a wife could be sold on the whim of a master. She could also be raped on the whim of a master, whether she was had a husband or not. And of course, her children were property, and they could be taken from her at a moment's notice. This was the destruction and the failure to create a black family over centuries, and we're still living with the legacy of that, and it would be foolish to deny it. Anyone who thinks that the past is dead, the past is never dead.
Kenneth Davis is the author of In the Shadow of Liberty, The Hidden History of Slavery, Four Presidents, and Five Black Lives. Kenneth, thank you so much for telling us about your new book.
Thanks, Rick, for having me. It's always a pleasure.
You might have heard us recently asking you what you would ask the candidates if you were a debate moderator. Well, Vermont Edition is deep in the planning for our debates for statewide offices, and our executive producer, Patty Daniels, joins me now for a preview. Patty, when do VPR's debates start?
Rick, they start 1 week from today. And if this election season seems like maybe it's gone on forever, you're not alone to feel that way. But we also know that a lot of people don't actually start really setting their minds to thinking about statewide races until deep into October. So in the final days before Election Day, we're giving you debates between the leading candidates to help you make your choices. And over the next 2 weeks, we'll bring you six debates for different offices.
All right, six debates over 2 weeks. What offices do those debates cover?
Okay. Attorney General, State Treasurer, and State Auditor. Those are the first three up. They start next week. After that, we have Lieutenant Governor, U.S. Senate, and finally Governor. Those three debates will be the week before Election Day. And the details of that schedule are on VPR.net. And we also have information pinned at the top of Vermont Edition's Twitter and Facebook feeds. So go back and refer to those places if you want to take note of when those debates are being held.
I already mentioned that we want listener questions in these debates. So give us a drill on how to send them in.
Okay, our top preference is to actually
that would be the top preference.
Top preference is to hear the questions in your own voice. So if you have a smartphone, open up the Voice Memo app and record yourself asking the question. Give us a little info, your name, your town, ask away, and then send that file to vermontedition@vpr.net. And if you don't have a smartphone, go ahead and email us your question. We might read it for you, or we might follow up with you to help you record it.
We've already received dozens of questions, but the more we get, the better we can choose questions that represent the priorities and concerns of many people. So please keep sending them in.
And a special plea for questions that you might have for Attorney General, Treasurer, and Auditor candidates. So think about the issues that connect with those offices. For AG, it might be anything related to crime and punishment. For the Treasurer candidates, it might be questions related to how and where the state pension funds are invested. any concerns you have about whether the state is spending its resources wisely, those questions are perfect for the state auditor candidates.
So again, record yourself on your smartphone or write it out. Either way, send it to vermontedition@vpr.net so we can put your questions in the mix for the debates starting next week. All the details are explained at vpr.net. Patty, thanks so much.
You got it, Rick.
And speaking of elections, when aren't we? You will not want to miss tomorrow's Vermont Edition. First thing tomorrow morning, VPR is releasing the results of our big new election poll. Where does the governor's race stand? What issues do Vermonters say are the most important to them? Are the Bernie supporters getting swayed by Hillary Clinton? We'll have the answers to all of these questions tomorrow and the results of the VPR poll, so join us live at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Sam Gale Rosen and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Rick Singeri. Thanks for listening.